Broadcasting from the studios of Business Radio X, it's time for Litigators Lounge. This show is brought to you by Hall Booth Smith, guiding clients through challenging workplace legal issues. Now, here are your hosts.
Good morning, good afternoon, whatever time of day you guys are listening to this. Thank you for tuning in into this week's episode of Litigators Lounge, your go-to source for insightful discussions on workplace dynamics and legal issues. I'm Jackie Voronov. I'm here with one of the most brilliant legal minds of our generation, nay, our time, Shiley Bannon. How you doing today, Shiley?
I'm good. I'm in my genius in the workplace era, as the Swifties would say. And here in the Litigators Lounge, it's always 5 o'clock, right?
Today especially, you know why?
Why?
Do you know what today is? It's a major national holiday.
Tell us what the holiday is.
Oh, Shiley, you disappoint me so. Today is Equal Pay Day. So the Litigators Lounge is going to be open early. We're going to stay late. Everyone is welcome to pull up a chair because we have a lot to talk about today.
Jackie, this is actually one of my favorite topics. I'm glad that we are back in present day to find out how the history lesson we got last time has shaken out to 2024. And I have had many conversations with you about this topic in the past. I know this is one of your passion projects that you love to collect data on this. How are we doing when we are getting into this? Is this something that we need to officially say, let's open the Litigators Lounge for?
Oh, yeah. Litigators Lounge is open. Let's get into it.
All right.
You know, Pay Equity Day, it's a national holiday for a reason. And I'm not sure that holiday is really the right terminology for it. We're not really celebrating anything as much as we're acknowledging the symbolism of this day. It's meant to denote how far into the year women have to work to be paid in order to get paid the same amount that men made the previous year. So to put it another way, women have to work approximately 448 to 450 days to earn what men earn in just 365 days. So I don't know why this concept of pay equity is as elusive as it is. It's like finding a unicorn in a field of four-leaf clovers. We can put a man on the moon. We just can't figure out how to pay everyone fairly. But here we are.
I think that's possibly also because we all think that we are special unicorns, right?
I know I am. And I certainly know that you are.
By the way, does the fact that this year was a leap year affect when Pay Equity Day falls at all?
Probably.
Yeah, I think we're celebrating it a day earlier.
Day early, yeah.
So tell us, where are we, broad strokes? What is pay equity? What are we doing in the United States right now in terms of pay equity between the genders on the 30,000-foot global scale, irrespective of race, irrespective of industry? Where are we? Give us the intro.
At this stage in the spectrum, we are still making pennies on the dollar compared to men. We're about, depending on the industry, depending on the region, depending on the position, women on average make about 84 cents on the dollar as compared to our male counterparts. It's a slow path to progress. Let's be honest. The Equal Pay Act was passed over 60 years ago. It predated Title VII. So this has been an increase of pennies year over year. So it is definitely a slow path.
And then that gap changes also depending on the industry that women are in. And then there are also different statistics based upon race and other factors as well, correct?
Yes. Are you dying for some statistics today?
I really love statistics. For example, in some of this information that I see here, Hispanic women earn only 54 cents for every dollar that a white man earns. That's a global statistic, right?
Yep.
Mothers are paid 58 cents for every dollar that fathers are paid.
Yeah. If you were to look at, based on that number, like you're saying 54 cents on the dollar for Hispanic women, right? Put that into another way of saying it. That means that in this year, in 2024, Hispanic and Latina women would have to work all the way until December 8th of 2024 to make what men earned last year. So for women of color, they would be working until September 21st, approximately, to make what men made last year. Moms, just as bad. There's, depending on how you cut the data, women over a certain age bracket, women under a certain age bracket, women with children are also having increased hurdles to achieving that pay equity. Women 65 plus suffer most from a gender pay gap, earning only approximately 74% of what their male counterparts earn.
How is this still happening when we have laws like the Equal Pay Act?
The Equal Pay Act, obviously, there's enforcement action that hasn't been taken. If, again, this is all my personal views. Things can still happen also, not just from an enforcement perspective, but because courts don't historically interfere with the business judgments of companies and employers. And it's been historically very easy for companies to defend their payroll decisions. Okay. So at its core, the Equal Pay Act says that no employer shall discriminate between employees on the basis of sex in paying wages to employees. That's filtered down to its most basic. And in order to establish a case under that Equal Pay Act, a plaintiff has to show that she or he, let's be honest, it's a she, are being paid different wages as compared to the opposite sex, that they do equal work, which requires equal skill, equal effort, equal responsibility, and that they have the same working conditions. That's a high burden to show that two positions are so substantially similar that you deserve to be paid the exact amount of money. And women historically have had a hard time proving that. And in the same vein, employers have had an easy time establishing, and as a defense attorney, I'll tell you I'm one of them. I'm probably the root of one of my own problems, which is we've got a variety of affirmative defenses justifying differences in positions, that being seniority, that being merit systems, that being showing that two positions are different in quality or quantity, or there's any other system. There's a catch-all defense that says any other factor that we consider other than sex, making these Equal Pay Act claims particularly easy to defend as compared to Title VII or e-claims or human rights law claims.
So for example, because most jobs are not just evaluated on pure productivity. It's not how many widgets did you make in an hour for every single job. So all of us, since we're getting into performance review season for anybody that you have to write reviews on, it's things like, is this person a team player? Is this person going above and beyond? Is this person taking on additional projects? Those are the kinds of things that can be used by employers to differentiate between employees in terms of pay, correct? Not to try to change or not to try to make a pay gap, but to reward people for contributing more or doing other things in their job besides making whatever widgets they're supposed to be making, right?
And it's how you're constantly comparing people who do different things with different day-to-day activities. And in this, especially on the C-suite level, there's this common misconception that on the scale between how much you earn, let's say hourly versus C-suite level employees, where the gender pay gap is the widest. If you were to ask or poll 100 people, where do you think the wage gap is the smallest versus where is it the largest? And in the reality is the higher level of education you attain, the larger the wage gap is, which is antithetical to what people typically think. They think the more learned I am and I have a master's and I have a PhD and therefore I'm going to be making all of this money. But the opposite has proven true.
You are singing the song of my immigrant parents.
Let's educate our daughters and make sure that they get paid less money.
I was always told, and I hear this from a lot of my friends who are first generation Americans, that you get more education, the more equal you will be, the more power you will have, the more free you will be, the more on par with everyone else you will be. That is the message that was drilled into all of our heads.
I'm the same thing. I was born and raised in Soviet Union, and I was told, listen, you're going to move to America. You're going to be a lawyer. We need a lawyer in the family. And I hate my parents every day for it.
What else would you be doing, though, besides talking the law with me?
I don't know. Maybe I could have had an Instagram account taking pictures of food. And I don't know, whatever else there is to do. Have you seen how much influencers make? I think that is the single most pay equitable industry right now. You could get into the world of social media content creation and make a killing.
I'm trying, but you keep roasting Epicurean Esquire.
I know. I know. I don't mean to impede your...
I would actually be very interested. This is a complete aside. I would actually be very interested to know what, if any, pay gap there is between male and female influencers on social media, because I tend to see a lot more female influencers than I do male influencers.
But who wants to see a male influencer? The women accounts are more interesting.
Yeah, that's a broad sweeping statement about gender.
I know, that's why I made it with this facial expression, hoping that you would catch on to it and be like, Jackie, that is so impropos.
But let's talk a little bit more about that C-suite group of women. So from my perspective, until I started seeing some of these statistics, I figured that would be the area where that gap would be the lowest. But you're telling me that's actually where the gap is the widest, correct?
That is exactly what I'm telling you. I'm telling you that everything that you've come to believe is wrong, because there's this idea that, you know, frontline workers, hourly wage earners, those closer to whatever the minimum wage is in any particular state have higher disparity. And the more education you have and the higher up executive wise you are, the lower that pay gap would be. The answer to why that's happening is because minimum wages and labor policies and laws create a wage floor such that when you're in those hourly wage positions, there's a bottom line that you can't go beneath, and people tend to be more equal. At the lowest 10th percentile, women get paid about 92 cents on the male dollar. When you get higher and you go into C-suite and higher level positions, the wage gap becomes wider is because a number of reasons, aside from the subjective components of the position and the type of the role, but there's also that the higher up in the C-suite you are, women are being penalized in a way for not working the same long and flexible hours, for motherhood, for back in COVID, they called it the great she session, where women left the workforce in droves because they didn't have childcare. And those rigorous work schedules that are attendant with those high executive level positions tend to weigh disproportionately heavier on women who are responsible for more housework and more childcare and things like that.
So one of the, because I really love statistics here, one of the statistics that you shared with me is that 60% of women across the spectrum, industry, all women in the United States, 60% believe that they are being paid equal to men. So 40% believe that they are not being paid equal to men. 78% of men think that they're being paid equal to women. So there's a little bit of a cognitive dissonance there. But Jackie, you did a study last year. You did a survey about women who are in the insurance and finance and legal insurance fields and what their perspectives were on this. Tell us what the difference is between that subsector of women and American women as a whole.
So what we did a year ago, I spoke at a Women in Insurance Leadership Conference, and we were presenting on the subject of pay equity. And I'm just fascinated by this subject. This is like my Epicurean, whatever it is, forget the name of your account, but this is my version of your Epicurean account.
To be fair, this is much more socially productive.
That's not true. I would submit that eating and photographing it is very socially productive. But I wanted to get a read on the room and the people that I'm surrounded with, right? Statistics are great and all, but I wanted to know what the people attending this conference really believed. So the question that we asked them in an anonymous survey was, do you believe that you earn the same as or on par with your male counterparts? And the results were really interesting. About 68% of the responding women did not believe that they got paid the same or on par with their counterparts. So approximately 2/3 of the room thought they were underpaid as compared to a male colleague, which it's about the same. But what was interesting was the conversation that ensued from there, because having established that we collectively believe that we don't get paid equitably, the question became, how do you know? How do you know you're not getting paid equitably? And the results to that question were far more surprising to me than what their belief was.
What were the results? Tell me about how people know.
For start, there's a lot of states. The starting point in some states would be pay transparency laws. That's one of the ways, to your point earlier, when you asked about how have we gotten to where we are and what are we going to do about it. A number of states do have pay transparency laws in effect, which require companies to post the salary ranges for their job postings, right? That's one way. The other way is talking about it. And in that regard, that's where my answers just started. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody.
That's probably because I know that I've been in jobs before, even though this is illegal under the NLRA, I have been in jobs before in white collar professions where supervisors have said to me, you really shouldn't talk about what you make with other people. You shouldn't discuss your salary or what other people's salaries are, because it's just going to breed resentment. And then I'm going to have to not reward you for your good work if other people start complaining about it. That's what people are still being told. I hear people in my family, my friends tell me that they are given that kind of directive all over the place. And every time somebody says that to me, I shake my head a little bit, because that's not really kosher according to the NLRA, right?
That's correct. I'm going to give you some more statistics to really whet your appetite here.
Okay. And
the question that was followed up with at the conference was, talking about the salary, right? How many people actually took steps to negotiate their salary, either at the time of hire or at any point during their employment? And about a third, 30% did not negotiate. And the number one reason they didn't negotiate is because they didn't want to be perceived as pushy. That word. They didn't want to be viewed as pushy.
Wow. That's one of those Price Waterhouse words.
Yeah. They have women. There's this ideal that women are perceived or should be cooperative negotiators, whereas men are competitive negotiators and they get things done and they're smart and capable. Whereas when women do it, we're greedy, we're demanding, we're getting, God forbid, we're bitchy. I mean,
shrill. That's another
shrill.
One.
Shrill. Yeah. We're too aggressive. We're intimidating. There's all this negative connotation and we believe it. That's the problem. We as women believe this idea that it's not other people telling us, hey, if you open up and say something, you're going to be viewed in a negative way. We've somehow convinced ourselves that's what the result is going to be. When the reality is that women who negotiate for a promotion or compensation are 30% more likely than men who negotiate to receive feedback that they're too bossy or too aggressive. That's not that much.
Do you think that this is like an internalized thought process, that women have heard it so much from men that they're starting to feel that way themselves, or that they don't, they recognize that there are these negative connotations and they feel like long-term negotiating short-term now for a smaller raise might hurt them long-term because they're going to be seen as too demanding? Do you think that it's that they don't actually, that women like to have data, women like to have statistics to back themselves up, and that information isn't available without pay transparency? What do you think it is that's causing women to have that viewpoint themselves?
A lot of organizations on the scale of transparency, not all companies are fully there. It's a very novel kind of concept that when asked how many people work for companies with full disclosure, where you get to know what all of the people and the your peers are making, very few actually work at a company like that. Full transparency. There might be some mid-range transparency where people share sort of job pay ranges and employees are told kind of the pay range, not the specifics of what other people are making. But I think that knowledge is power, yes, but that's only a piece of it. I think part of the other problem is this ideal that we're capable, as an attorney, I think it's really an interesting phenomenon, which is we are charged with arguing and presenting and fighting a cause on behalf of somebody. But we as female attorneys are far more hesitant and reserved in fighting that cause when it comes to ourselves. And I don't know the answer to why we are so aggressive and powerful and we are just kicking butt and taking names on behalf of others. But when it comes to doing it for ourselves, we clam up.
It's really interesting. It's going to cause some self-introspection that perhaps I need another lychee martini for to
it really helps if you've got three. I found that to be the magic number. You'd be shocked how much more open you are to discuss both pay transparency, pay equity, and a whole host of other subjects with just a few of those.
For myself, I do know that I do like to have data. I like to know, are my expectations unreasonable? Am I out of touch with reality, so to speak, or am I really looking at what my value is? So in a lot of these fields, like law, there are objective measures, like our productivity, but then there are also the intangibles, like we were talking about before. And like to your point, there are things that are more difficult for women in the traditional gender construct to do with rainmaking or with additional leadership tasks or these long hours. But is that being recognized? Is that something that companies need to be more proactive about? Is that something that companies can actually promote pay equity within the ranks by giving more transparency and by setting objective, measurable benchmarks for pay milestones?
In a perfect world, I'm sure. From a company perspective, if your goal and you are really committed to narrowing the wage gap, conducting pay audits is certainly the best way to do that, to, for each organization to do an introspective look at its own data. Take a look at what your highest paid executives make. Take a look at what the men make. Take a look at what the women make and compare that data. Review it. Pay audits are conducted only by about 10% of organizations. That's astonishingly low. So again, that's one of those contributing factors. I would recommend that anybody who isn't just doing lip service to equity, especially during this Women's History Month, and when you talk about your commitment to diversity, to equity, to inclusion, it's all of it. It's not just about a day or a month. So doing audits, I think, is a really valuable tool and a really great way to ensure that you're not just all talk.
One thing that was really interesting to me in the data that you gave me, Jackie, is that you gave me a map of the gender pay gap.
And I gave you a map?
Of the 50 states, yeah.
I did do that? That sounds so unlike me.
And you, in this map, it shows that states like New Jersey and Massachusetts, and I'm really interested in that because you live in New Jersey. And we often talk about how New Jersey and Florida are very different in the way that they approach equal employment opportunity legislation and also political approaches, which we all love to discuss about the Florida woman, and sometimes the Florida woman, because we are equal opportunity down here in Florida. So what do you think about that? What does that signify to you?
Just to highlight what you're talking about here for our listeners, and I where you live makes a big difference in terms of the wage gap. So in states like Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, states that are historically, and I'm using air quotes here for people who can't see, blue states are more liberal states and states that have very strict pay transparency, labor laws on the books. Those tend to be the states with higher wage gap differentials. And that's somewhat of an anomaly because on paper, they're supposed to be at the forefront of leading the employee cause. When all things equal rights are New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, right? But in terms of dollar figure, the wage gaps are higher by $15,000 or higher in those states. And the states where the lowest wage gaps are like California, Nevada, Florida, Georgia, typically red states, with the exception of California, obviously, but...
Yeah, I'm curious about California. But then when we look at the states that actually have pay transparency laws, they're
states.
I'm sorry?
It's those states.
It is. And it's there is some, if you lay these two maps on top of each other, there is some overlap. And it's just very interesting to me. I wonder if we're going to see that start to change, since I think pay transparency laws are a fairly new thing that's sweeping the nation as much as they are. At least that's what I can tell when I see people talking on LinkedIn.
They're slow on the uptick, but I think that a pay transparency law, giving a salary range, employers, they haven't exactly been doing it in the most...
Oh, like the salary
transparent way. The name of the law.
The range is anywhere from $100,000 to $600,000. Exactly. The range.
Yeah. And that's what they're doing. You just have to give a good faith range for the positions. And okay, I'll fall somewhere in that. You love social media, so you'll appreciate this story. There was this viral post on LinkedIn. All things employment go on LinkedIn, right? And it was posted by a female HR recruiter. And she bragged about the fact that she had a budget of, I think it was $130,000. And then she posted that, oh my God, I just hired this woman for $85,000. This will teach her that she really should open up if she wants to get paid. And they just crucified this woman. The post has obviously long ago been deleted. But, you know, this is a female who works in recruiting, who's bragging and boasting about how she just undercut another woman when it comes to salary. So we cannot just sit back and say, okay, pay equity. It's women versus men. That's an unfair characterization of what the reality is. We are our own worst enemy. There's other females out there when it comes to pay equity who are not doing us any favors. And it's this convergence of events and factors and problems that until we overcome this kind of mentality, that we're just always going to be moving on this slow path forward and pennies over pennies.
Now, what about if you go into a job interview, and this applies for both men and women, but what about if you go into a job interview and things are going well and they ask you, what are you making at your current job or what were you making at your last job? Why are they asking that?
So that they can do just that, the exact thing that recruiter just did, right? It's to tell you, here's what you were making, and now I'm going to offer you either the exact same or very little above that so that they can get down to that number. Because remember, these people who were, they're trying to make themselves look good too. They're trying to show their own company, I saved a few dollars for us and I hired this person and it was a steal. And that's their review come bonus time. But you can't do that in a number of states where there's salary bans, ban the box laws when it comes to salary. You're not allowed to ask. In New Jersey, you're not allowed to ask anybody's current salary. When you're doing interviews in New York, you're not allowed to ask. You are, however, allowed to ask a variation of the question. You can say, what salary are you looking for? And in that regard, here's where I would recommend people speak up. Don't use your current salary as the benchmark and put in that number. When you fill in the blank, be honest about it. Just say, here's where I want to be. It's a novel concept, I know.
Do you think that it needs to be more of a discussion if the person is shooting for the stars and the stars have been way overshot in terms of what would be realistic for that position? Do you think that the company owes it at that point to tell the candidate that and say, listen, that's really not what we're looking at in this range?
Problem is, money is so taboo. Money is such a taboo subject. And again, I took to social media to impress you. I just want you to know that. And I took to social media and I wanted to just read the comments about pay equity laws and things that people are saying. And having conversations is all well and good. We could sit here on this podcast and say to each other, I think Shiley, you should talk about it. Or I think Jackie, you should say this and say that. It is not that simple. When you're sitting there in the seat, in the hot seat, and you're meeting somebody for the first time, we can't even have a frank discussion with our peers. I once went out with a friend of mine who I met in college, and she and I had been we were roommates. So when I tell you that I have seen this girl at her every worst possible phase of life, okay, from I'm talking waxing and the most horrible nights you can imagine. At Pennsylvania State University.
Thankfully, that was before Facebook.
And before social media made it popular to advertise this. I know this girl's life. But when I ask her, hey, what do you make like at your current job? She froze. She said, I don't think that's a really appropriate topic to talk about. And I was like, girl, you're telling me, the girl who lived with you through 4 years of Penn State University, about what's appropriate and inappropriate? Okay, we'll take that at face value. But We clam up. It's too taboo of a subject. So we have not gotten past, I think, the hurdles that we have based on sort of society's, you know, conception of norms of things we shouldn't talk about as quickly as maybe pay equity conceptually has evolved.
One of the ways in addition to education, that we are encouraged to increase our salary and our earnings is by taking on increased responsibility at work, right? Obviously, the way that we get up through our ranks, the way that we continue to increase our salary is by taking on increased responsibility, increased roles. In law, you're an associate, you want to become a partner. You become a partner, you want to become a shareholder. You become a shareholder, you want to become one of the managing shareholders. In insurance, you become an account executive, you want to become a group executive. You want to make it all the way to a C-suite executive. In any field, you're encouraged to keep striving for that next level to increase not only your responsibility, but your salary. And how is that something that contributes to that gender pay gap for women?
I think that's a great question. I think you should answer it. I'm going to flip the table on you now, miss. I've been in the hot seat the whole time talking about it. I'm just one lowly woman in this population of women everywhere. I don't purport to know all the answers. Help me help you.
Okay. I'll give you an example. All of the associates in my office went out for a happy hour the other day.
They invited you?
No, they didn't invite me. It was an all associate happy hour. And I quipped to one of them. I was like, oh, thanks for the invite. And they said, come be an associate and you can join us. And I turned around and I said, gladly, then I don't have to deal with all the administrative responsibilities that I have to deal with. First of all, we treat associates very nicely here. But secondly, there are so many additional responsibilities that when I'm thinking about them, and I'm a mother, I have a 6-year-old son at home, and I live in a very progressive by traditional gender standards marriage, where my husband takes on candidly more than his share of a 50-50 division of labor in our household. There are still times that if I'm planning a birthday party for my son and dealing with doctor's appointments, and by the way, the thing that I'm dealing with right now is trying to put together his summer day camp schedule, which actually is harder to do than to go to a jury trial. While I'm doing all of those things, having to take on the financial management aspects of being a partner in a law firm, the client communications, making sure my clients are happy, making sure that everybody is following all these guidelines, all of that, and practice law and maintain a caseload, I see why there are a number of women who say, this is too much for me, especially when they don't have all of the support that I personally have, where they say, I don't really want to be the head honcho. I don't want to be that manager. Is that...
Well, I 100% get it. I completely agree with it. Women are expected to do everything. You're the mother, the housekeeper, the chef, the teacher, the nurse, the coach, the storyteller, the monster killer, the planner. You're Wonder Woman. You're the multitasking queen, or in your household, your husband is all of these things.
He is. So, Jesse, you know, I love you.
When you're the primary caretaker in your household, there's this potential for that to impede the ability to go out, to market, to drum up, to be on the golf courses, to be at the conferences, to be at the work events and drumming up new business. And for that reason, this is a contributing factor. Let me ask you a question. Do you know which industry is historically the greatest wage gap?
I don't. I think... Are we talking about across the entire industry, or are we talking about at the C-suite level? Is it insurance?
Yes. Do we have a sound like edit that I can play? You can be like, you're right. Yeah. Like confetti explodes.
Well, yeah, I think that we can add that in post-production. So listeners, when you hear this, you will know that we have achieved
the possible
advancement. Yes. Yes. Okay.
Yes. You are 100% correct. It is the insurance industry. It has the largest uncontrolled wage gap. And the reason for that is all of those things that you just pointed out before, which is you have to get out in the forefront in the insurance world, and you have to be at these events. You have to be drumming up business where your worth is tied directly to how much new business you generate. Anything that you're doing other than just being married to your desk, your office, your client list, your prospective client list, marketing all the time, 24/7, round the clock, no breaks, you are going to find hurdles and challenges. So I extend this invitation to any listeners out there who are women working in insurance, who are women working in C-suite levels, to take what we're saying to heart and start thinking about your own organizations and what can you do in your positions of power to start leveling the playing field. Because at this rate, if we keep going at the rate that we're going, our daughters and their daughters will never see pay equity in their lives. We will not, it will take until past the year 2100 to ever achieve pay equity at the rate that we're going.
And for the record, I think that some of this was talked about by Sheryl Sandberg in her book 10 years ago, Lean In. And I think that we have moved away from some of those traditional thoughts, which was just women need to work harder in the workplace. I don't think that's necessarily the answer.
I don't know how much harder I think a lot of women could work. That's you're now going to have the reverse effect. You're going to have an employee retention problem. But going back to pay audits, I will tell you that high performance organizations are 3 times more likely to do a pay audit. So there's benefit to it. Your ability to deliver a good product to have your bottom line affected. So I reiterate and emphasize and take a big highlighting fluorescent marker and say that companies should do gender pay audits.
And should also have women weighing in on the factors that are going into pay decisions.
Yeah, take a look at who's actually making the pay decisions. And if you're a woman making the pay decisions and you're paying women less, ask yourself why you hate women. I don't know. Maybe, listen, if there's one thing we as women are good at, it's resilience in the face of absurdity. So this will fix itself. It's just that I don't think that it'll be in our lifetime.
Thank you, Jackie, for bringing up this topic. I know it's, like I said, one of your passions, and I think that comes across very well. I know that I like to get paid more too, so it's one of my passions by default as well. But that is what we have time for today. For our listeners, if you have any questions, comments, feedback on this topic or any other topic that we've covered or you'd like us to cover, please send us an email at litigatorslounge@hallboothsmith.com. And until next time, Jackie, cheers.
Cheers, Shiley. Good to see you.
Thank you for joining us on Litigators Lounge. This show is brought to you by Hall Booth Smith, helping clients navigate the complexities of workplace legal issues. For more information, go to hallboothsmith.com.
Litigators Lounge is a production brought to you by Hall Booth Smith. This podcast is published for the purposes of providing general information and education on topics which include those related to the law and legal issues, but the contents of this podcast do not constitute legal advice. Listening to this podcast or utilizing the information contained in it in any way does not constitute, nor does it create, an attorney-client relationship between you and Hall Booth Smith or its lawyers. The contents of this podcast should not be used as a substitute for competent legal advice from a professional attorney licensed in your jurisdiction.